Hi, John. Welcome to the Tasnua meeting, and I'm happy to hand the meeting over to you.
Well, thank you, Jan. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm John. I'm a average alcoholic and happy to be dealt into another hand today. It's always good to be at a meeting. I used to go to a lot of Tasnua meetings, as I mentioned before. But unfortunately, my teaching schedule has gotten to interfere with the meeting I used to go to because some of my classes are in China, so I have to get up really early and do those. So I kind of miss it. But when daylight savings time comes again, I'll probably be able to do that because we don't do daylight savings time in Arizona. We use God's time in Arizona. We don't muck around with that stuff. And anyway, so my home group is the Freethinkers Living Sober group. We used to be in Cottonwood, Arizona, which is where I live, but as a face-to-face meeting. We started in 2014, but when COVID hit, we went to Zoom, and now we're entirely on Zoom, and we'll continue that way. So now we can't say we're from any particular place because there's people from all over the place that come to the meeting, and which is great. My sobriety is my date is April Fool's Day of 1981, so that's 16,040 days for those of you who are counting. It was a very different environment in AA in those days, at least where I got sober. It was not so well. A lot of the mainstream meetings now seem to be really tight-assed, I guess is the way I would put it. They seem to really want you to, if you don't have God, you won't be able to stay sober and blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to get into a critique, but wasn't like that when I got sober. We had lots of agnostics and atheists around. I was not an agnostic or an atheist when I got sober. I had been in the ministry for a number of years. And I was a drunk who talked about God, and it didn't get me sober, didn't keep me sober. So I when I was a kid, I was what they I guess I would call I was a ultimate seeker. I was always seeking. I think a lot of that was because there was something missing, and I think, as I've read around, I think it was a lack of secure attachment to anybody in my family, whether it was a mother or a father or anything else. And so I was really kind of lost and wondering a lot. And I remember going to all kinds of different churches and stuff when I was a kid, 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and searching something out and never settled on one. By the time I was about, I think the first drink I ever had, I was about 9 years old. I had a cold. My brother had had a really bad hangover, so my dad made us both hot toddy to help cure our problem. It seemed like a good idea at the time, and but I started drinking right around that time. Actually, I started doing acting in the theater. And I was about 11, I think, when I did my first non-school type of acting. And the nice thing about being in theater productions is they have these things afterwards, called cast parties. And nobody cared if the kids were drinking or not drinking or whatever. So I had an opportunity to drink at those, and I loved it. By the time I got to high school, and we had, because I had been drinking a little bit in what we called middle school, by the time I got to high school, I had a flask that looked like a book, and I took that with me to school, and a lot of the other kids in high school, they'd go into the bathroom, and I've noticed in the last decade or so, I had the opportunity to end up in a high school to do a talk, and I went into the bathroom, and they had no doors on the stalls anymore. and two-way mirrors and all of that kind of stuff. They didn't have that when I was in high school. So other kids would go in there to smoke, but I didn't smoke. I wouldn't smoke. Instead, I went in there to drink, and so I'd sit in the bathroom stall and have a couple of toots before the next class. So I started drinking pretty young, and I went from being in honors classes my freshman year of high school to being in remedial classes by the time I was a senior. If you miss 35% of the class days, they generally don't give you great grades. And so I was pretty much a rabble rouser when I was in high school, and I hung out with a lot of the kids that were kind of, we had what we called the social people, and then we had the people who were kind of jocks, the athletic people, and then we had the people like me who were kind of antisocial or anti the mainstream type deal. And I had a pretty good time. I just barely graduated high school, and they supposedly had a committee that went around and told the teachers, "I you need to get this guy out of here. He doesn't belong here." And so I ended up graduating. I didn't think I would, graduating from high school, and I didn't know what to do. I thought about going into the armed forces. I wanted to become a helicopter pilot, and my brother got back from Vietnam in 66, and he convinced me not to go into the armed forces. He said, "No, it's all BS. You don't want to go into that. It's this war is worthless. It's stupid. It's all about things that don't concern us, and don't do it." So I didn't know what to do, so I went to college, and I went to college, and I ended up on the dean's list. I don't know how that happened, except that I kept showing up, and I really enjoyed it, that's where I got introduced to a lot of other things besides alcohol, and pretty much enjoyed it. Although, one of the guys in those days, it was basically all about hippies and peace, love, and all that stuff. And the thing that I didn't particularly notice at the time was I was probably one of the few people that, when they were on an acid trip or LSD or psilocybin or whatever happened to be taking at the time, I always had to have a jug of wine with me. And that probably should have told me something right there, but it didn't. And a lot of my friends said that they thought that I had a drinking problem, which I thought was absurd. And but I never felt really good. I felt really, even though I had friends, I always felt kind of out of sorts with everybody. And so we had this group of people show up on the campus one year. And what they used to call them, Jesus freaks. And this group seemed like they all seemed like they were really tight, and loving, and they all played guitar, which I'd been playing guitar for years by that time. I did a lot of shows and stuff because I was a singer and an actor, so I did a lot of concerts and that kind of stuff. So I really got into it and really enjoyed it. And they seemed to have the answers, that I didn't have. Not that I would have told anybody I didn't have them, so I ended up going with them. And I was pretty much in that group for about 9 years. And we set up houses around the country and that kind of stuff. And I'd been ordained when I was in 1969 through the Universal Life Church, which was a new thing at that time, where you could get ordained without any kind of credentials or anything. But then ended up taking another ordination later with that group. But by the time we got up into the 70s, and that's the longest period of time I went without drinking, by the way, was when I was with that group, until it became okay to drink again. And I don't think they knew what they were in for when they said it was okay. So right around 1978 or 79, something like that, I can't remember when, they started getting really weird. They started doing all kinds of weird stuff, and a lot of sexual liberation and all that kind of stuff, which isn't really your mainstream Christian deal. So I ended up leaving and coming back to California. I'd been traveling all over the states at that time, and came back to California, and then I really started drinking. Now I had a wife and I had children at that time, and so I needed to work, obviously. I needed to do something, and my acting career had kind of gone by the wayside when I started doing that Christian stuff. So I really didn't have access to that kind of work. And so I started doing stuff like I sold life insurance for a while, and my family had a business that I helped with that business, although I don't know how much help I was because I was drinking so much all the time. And it got really bad. I mean, I was really out there. I remember working in my family's business, and at lunch, I'd go across the street to my local bar. And in those days, you could get a call drink for 90 cents. Not anymore, but back then you could get it for about 90 cents. So what I would do is I would count the number of dimes that I had left on the bar. And when I got up to 9 or 10 dimes, then I'd go back to work. Well, that's, 9 or 10 drinks. And obviously I didn't last very long working that afternoon, so I would have to go home. I remember one of the scariest things that ever happened to me was I had gone to get one of my girls, my little girls, from their school to take her home, and I did take her home, but I didn't remember that when I left the bar. I didn't take her with me to the bar, but I thought, what the hell did I do with my daughter? Where is she? And I was turning a corner, and the passenger side door opened while I was turning. And I thought, oh my God, did she fly out of the truck? What happened? What happened? So I was not in good shape. Let's put it that way. I was not in good shape at all, and I had a lot of anxiety. I was really starting to get suicidal at that point. It was one of my favorite songs back then was a Peggy Lee song. Is That All There Is? For those of you who've ever heard of that song, but it was not good. I was not in good shape at all, and I ended up selling life and disability insurance. And actually, I did really well with that. I was one of the top sellers, and so the insurance company, actually sent me to the convention in Bermuda. That was in 1981. And I went to the convention, and I did what I always did. I drank, and I remember being in a restaurant and confronting a couple of priests at the restaurant, drunk. And this friend of mine that I was with, only reason I didn't get arrested was because he happened to be a deputy sheriff from New York. And he showed his badge to the guy who was going to arrest me, and he said, "I'll take care of him. I'll take care of him. He's just, having a tough time." So I ended up not getting arrested. But I was at that convention, and the last night of the convention, I went up to my room, and I had tried to not drink that day. And I then I was fairly successful with not drinking that day. And I met a guy at the coffee shop who also didn't drink. Now, I have no idea whether he was in AA or what the deal was, but he was sober. And we sat and we talked for a long time. And then it was probably 8 or 9 o'clock. And he did this really weird thing. He went off to go to bed. And I was not in any shape to go to bed. It's like I was nervous, anxious, really. Sleep? What are you talking about? And I ended up in the bar with a drink that was a really short pour. I always drank in local bars, so I never had to worry about short pours. And I really didn't know how I got there or why I was there. And that's really when I got it, that whole idea of we, because I didn't really know about the we admitted. I was trying to do it on my own, you know. And I'd gone to a couple of meetings, but they had like God on the wall, and they had all these people that, you know, were old, and they didn't look like they ever drank because they were so old and they had been sober for so long and they couldn't possibly be alcoholics. And so I went, I was really surprised. I was really surprised. I'm having trouble getting my, I hate this word. If I click on the wrong thing, it covers my whole screen and it throws me off. Anyway, so so I went back up to my room and I was really anxious and everything else laying there. And when I woke up that morning, I felt like I couldn't move. My heart was pounding like crazy. My left arm was sore and everything else. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. What's going on? So I just started trying to breathe and because, you know, I'm working for a life insurance company. I don't want to call them and tell them I'm having a heart attack. I'll never be insurable. Right? So I didn't want to do that. So I don't know. It took probably 10 or 15 minutes for me to finally be able to move again. And so I went down and I went and did a little swimming, which is one of the things I love to do for exercise. And I got it. I got it. I need to have help with this drinking thing. I'm not going to be able to do it by myself. And so that was on April Fool's Day of 1981. And I flew back to California, which is where I got sober in Ventura, California, at a place that was upstairs on Main Street. And if you go up these stairs, as you go up the stairs, they were numbered. There were 12 steps to get upstairs, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong. You know, that's the other thing about this. I'm going by my memory. So, you know, believe as much as you want to believe and don't believe what you don't, because I may be wrong. It's happened before. And so I ended up at this place, the Alano Club in Ventura, California. And there's a whole bunch of people there. And they were all, seemed to me like they were all old and they were all on disability. And because I was going to noon meetings, I don't know what I expected. People who are going to noon meetings are, you know. So I went up there and I hung out, and I didn't like the whole God thing that was involved, because, you know, like I said, I'd done the God thing, and I was a drunk who'd done the God thing, and it didn't seem to really work for me. And besides, you know, I turned my back on Jesus, and that's like the worst thing you can possibly do. There's no salvation from that, according to the group I was with. And anyway, I hung in there, asked a guy to sponsor me. He said yes. And 2 weeks later, he left town. okay, I get it. They don't want to have anything to do with me. I asked another guy. I was about 9 months sober. Finally, I stayed sober. I was about 9 months sober. It was like my insides were coming out. I was just a wreck. I was in and out of suicidal thoughts and just not really doing well at all. And I didn't know if I was going to make it in this deal. And I was just coming apart. And so the guy I asked then to sponsor me was this the one guy in AA I really didn't like. He was a kickboxer and an ex-Marine and tough as nails. And this is the guy I asked to sponsor me. And I don't know if it was because I needed the abuse or what, but just whatever it was, he hung in with me a lot. I wasn't able to write. I've been a writer all my life. It's something I've always done. It's write. And he hung in with me because I just couldn't write. They talk about doing the fourth step. I tried, and he'd sit there in a coffee shop with me, and he'd put down a word, and I'd put down a word, and he'd put down a word, and I'd put down, and we just do it like that, like one word at a time, literally. And we did a meeting together that he started in his backyard on one day. It was the Monday we'd do the fourth step, and on Wednesday we'd do a fifth step. And that's how I ended up being able to do any of the fourth or fifth step. I thought like I was really fortunate that I didn't have anybody telling me what I had to believe and how I had to believe it. I mean, there were people talking about higher powers and all that stuff, but nobody got into theology or any of that kind of stuff. Because if they had, I probably would have just argued with them because I knew a lot about theology, at least from the narrow perspective that I had as a fundamentalist. And so he really helped me a ton. And I went to him one day after about 2.5 years sober. And I told him I was having a lot of trouble with some of these people that were trying to talk to me about Jesus and about Christianity and all that stuff. And that what ended up happening is I'd end up bringing up different Bible verses and stuff because I had memorized all that stuff, and sometimes they'd end up in tears, and I didn't want that to happen, and I didn't like getting into those conflicts and stuff. I really didn't want to. And what he told me, he says, "Well, you know what?" He says, "I don't know anything about all that stuff. So what you need to do is you need to find somebody like the Pope or somebody that really knows their shit about all of that and talk to them." And so I ended up going to a retreat center that I used to go to all the time. It was actually a Franciscan retreat center. And I had called and asked if there were any retreats. And the woman there, she actually knew me because I'd been going there for years. And she said, "Well, we don't have any openings now, but I'll put you on the list." And she called me back a few days later and she says, "You know, it's the weirdest thing." She says, "We have a retreat coming up, and there is an opening, but it's a retreat for recovering alcoholics. So I don't know if you'd want to go." And I said, "Yeah, I'll go." And she didn't know I was an alcoholic. She didn't know that about me. And so I went to this retreat, and it turns out the guy who was leading the retreat was a recovering alcoholic. His name was Father Bill. He said his name was Father Bill Wilson, his name was. He says, "I'm not that Bill Wilson," he says. And he and I sat for well, several hours and talked, and it was great. He really helped me out. I was having all these conflicts about all of these old beliefs that I had based on the way that I was taught scriptures and I was taught all this prophecy and all of that stuff. And basically he just said, "You know what? That He said, the Bible's maybe good for a lot of guys, but for guys like you and me," and here's this priest telling me this, he says, "but for guys like you and me," he says, "just stick with a big book and keep it simple and don't worry about any of that shit." And it's like I got permission to not even think about all that. And that helped me for several years of sobriety. It didn't cure, quote unquote, my depression. Now, I didn't know I was depressed. I had no idea that I had depression. I just thought I was doing something wrong. If you work the steps right and you do it consistently, it'll solve all your problems. That's what some people said. And it's horse shit, but that's what they said. And sorry if anybody disagrees with that, but that's just my opinion. And I could be wrong. So anyway, I ended up at 11 years sober in a treatment center in Arizona. And I was there in one of the sections of the treatment center that everybody that was in that, you know, they have groups that are in different treatments, parts of the treatment center. And in my group, every single person there was double-digit sobriety. They were not there to try and not drink. They were there to try and figure out why their life sucked, and why they were having so many emotional problems. And they do this whole battery of tests. They do this whole battery of tests. And finally, I went into the psychiatrist, and he was looking at all these tests, and he says, "Well, so how long have you been depressed?" And I'm like, "Is that what this is? I just thought I wasn't enough. I wasn't, you know, that's been the story of my life. I'm just not enough." And he said, "Well, no, this is depression. You're seriously depressed." And I had no idea that that's what it was. Like I said, I just thought I was not doing the steps right, or I wasn't praying enough, or I wasn't doing this, or I wasn't doing that. And I had started kind of getting into Buddhism and studying Buddhism, because when I was in college, I had studied a lot of that kind of stuff, Taoism and Buddhism and that kind of thing. And so they, I spent, what was it, 27 or 28 days in the treatment center, and it really helped. I mean, I'll tell you, having that experience was very helpful to me, because what I think I came to is I finally realized that all my life I had been trying to do whatever it was I had to do in order to finally be enough. And spirituality for me in those days, that is, religious spirituality, because I don't think all spirituality has to be religious, but that my idea was that if I would just get high enough, spiritual enough, I'd overcome all of this stuff. You know, I'd end up on the top of the mountain in long flowing robes, you know, and be untouched by anything like a human emotion. And that's when I first got it. What I've come to understand was spiritual bypassing. Some of you may have seen, you know, we did a series of workshops a few years back on emotional sobriety. Josie and Dr. Alan B. and Mara H. and I presented a series of workshops on emotional sobriety, and mine was on spiritual bypassing. Because what I realized is that's basically what I was trying to do. I was trying to not have to deal with all this stuff that supposedly the steps get you to, you know, those underlying emotional conflicts. But it really was more of, for me, even meditation was really more about trying to rise above and trying to get beyond and transcend. And I ended up really not dealing with a lot of stuff, especially for my religious trauma and a lot of the stuff from my childhood, and feeling totally disconnected and like I didn't belong, and that aching loneliness, even when you're around a whole bunch of people. I actually around a whole bunch of people, I felt more alone than any other time, and so I started looking at things from a little bit different perspective. Like, it's not about trying to become a bodhisattva. You know, it's not about trying to become a guru or any of that kind of stuff. Like, the highest I'll ever get is to be a human being, and that's enough. Well, that was a breakthrough for me. I mean, I may sound stupid, but that really was a breakthrough for me. I had no idea that that was what was going on with me. And so some of you may have heard the workshop I did on spiritual bypassing. I don't know. But I found that it doesn't just happen in a religious context. You know, spiritual bypassing is just one more way of trying to avoid or deny or suppress anything that's going on. And it can be trauma-based, or it can be just avoiding conflicts in relationships. I think a lot of problems in relationships is just sheer avoidance and trying to ignore what's really going on. That's been my experience. I think for me, I know a lot of people don't like the word spiritual or the word spirituality, but for me, I think that spirituality or spiritual just means a deeply felt sense of connection to something that's within yourself and beyond yourself, maybe inner peace or inner connection with nature. I love being able to be out in the trees in Flagstaff because I can just lay there and it's like medicine. Or it could be, you know, a connection with the universe. I don't feel real connected with the universe. It's a little too big for me, but anything that inspires awe or purpose, that to me is what spiritual is. It doesn't have anything to do with metaphysics or religion or anything like that. So spirituality is just about anything that would foster growth, and awareness and what I found is that sometimes doing meditation can actually be a form of spiritual bypassing. Because what happened for me was I was so busy trying to be detached from everything and not have to feel all that stuff. Rather than equanimity, which is one of the things that's talked about in meditation, is finding some equanimity. It became more like indifference, which is not the same thing at all. And so I think one of the things I also got into this whole idea of what they call the embodied mind. That, you know, I always thought of the mind as being what's up here in your head that you think with. But actually what neurology has found is that there is a mind that's in the gut and there's a mind that's in the heart. That is, there are neurons that communicate with the brain up here and back and forth that, you know, when people say, well, I have this gut feeling, well, that's pretty much what that is. But I was the kind of guy, and they used to talk about this, and I really identified with it. I was the kind of guy that was so in my head that I would have killed my body, except I needed it for transportation. You know, so what I found was I really needed to find a way to get into my body, to get into the emotions, and not into them in the sense of rolling around and being overwhelmed by emotion. Actually, I think I had more propensity to get overwhelmed by an emotion when I was trying to deny it. Or suppress it than if I would just allow myself to be with it. And that's one of the things that's really helped me a lot over the years. The other thing I've found is that, you know, I've learned a whole lot of things since I've been in sobriety. And what I found is that at any given moment, it's not like I get over using those tools of spiritual bypassing. I have to watch for it. I have to watch for when I'm not really paying attention to what's really going on internally and externally. I used to take on other people's emotions a lot. I take on what happened with somebody else, especially when I came out as being an agnostic and later a non-theist. You know, people would roll their eyes or they'd leave the room and blah, blah, blah. And I kind of take on, like, I was responsible for how they felt. And that's one of the things that was really helpful for me was when I realized that, no, I'm responsible for my feelings and my thinking and my actions, but I'm not responsible for how they take things and how they feel about it, even though they want to blame me for it. It's not my responsibility. That's like being an adult almost, you know, it's kind of weird. And, But that can be very difficult for people who want you to take responsibility. But then there's a balance to that too. Like on Christmas Day of 2022, my wife had a stroke. It was her second stroke, and it's been a very serious situation. And so I've had to take on the responsibility for things like making our meals and taking care of her, making sure that I check her vitals and do all of that stuff. That's not anything that I was trained for or was ready for. So this last couple of years has actually been more difficult probably than almost any other time in my sobriety, other than maybe the first few years. They were very, very difficult, and I wouldn't want to go through that again for all the tea in China. But she's doing a lot better, and she's able to speak again. She's able to get up and walk around and do things, and so that's very cool. And I've talked more than I thought I was going to. I probably should shut up about now because I've gone on and on. But I have to say that for anybody who's having any kind of trouble with this kind of stuff, with depression or anxiety, they used to tell me, "Oh, that's an outside issue." And I got to tell you, that's bullshit. If it's inside of me, it's an inside issue. That's how I feel about it. Now, I don't necessarily talk about it all the time because everybody's different. What I experience as a chronic depressive may not be what you experience that way. And the fact that I had serious anxiety, and I don't anymore, most of the time, I'd say 90% of the time, doesn't mean that what I did is what's going to work for you. I don't know what your journey is for or how it's going to work. I can only tell you what happened with me. Some people need a different path. And that love and tolerance of others is really important because to me, where we connect is in how we're human and how we go through stuff and how we support each other. And to me, that's the important thing that I've gotten. And I don't really go to a whole lot of mainstream meetings anymore, mainly because I'm kind of stuck making sure that I take care of business here, and I work online, and I try and take care of my half side, Mahasane, which is what we call them in Lakota. And so I don't experience a lot of the stuff that I used to experience whenever I talk about not believing in God. But that's how we started the AA meeting, the Free Thinkers meeting, was because I mentioned anytime there was a newcomer, if the meeting got too gaudy, I would talk about not believing in God and being sober a long time. And a couple of guys came up to me and asked if I'd help them start a meeting that would be open for alcoholics who were agnostic or atheist or free thinkers. And that's how it started. And I'm really glad it did because I think it's helped a lot of people. I hope it has. And I'll shut up now. I've talked way too long. Thanks. It's really good to see everybody too. Thanks.